Welcome to minute 66 of season 8 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Sam Edwards, an associate professor at Loughborough University in England, a professor of modern history. Welcome back to the, I hope I got that right. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back.
All right. So minute 66 begins with Mike trying to give Miller some advice and ends with Wade scribbling in the dark of the night. So we ended things on Friday with Mike and Miller having a intimate candlelight conversation about PTSD. Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, we touched a little bit about this on Friday, but I like the way that they do this because it comes across as very realistic because it's as things are happening, it isn't done in a way, it's not forced.
Yeah. Yeah. It has a natural quality to it. It feels like the conversation works, right? Given what we've just seen and where they are, it feels like a natural conversation. It's not overdone. It's not overwrought. It's not forced. Yeah, it's well handled.
Right. I think if they were to make that scene today, it wouldn't come across as realistic because I think today that it would be within the climate of the world that we're living in today in 2024/2025. I think that making this scene, they would have to acknowledge more as to what's going on, as opposed to letting us, go through the trail of breadcrumbs to figure out what it is that's going on with Miller.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it also, it takes, I think, a director of Spielberg's skills. There's, because this is what he's so great at, right? Saying lots, but in a very kind of tactful, nuanced, careful, not overdone kind of a way. And he handles it really well here.
Correct. But even Spielberg has changed over the last 27 years, because of the way that the world has changed. So I don't think that Spielberg would have been able to make this movie the same way that he made it if he were to be making it today. I mean, it goes along with many of his movies, including Schindler's List. There are probably many aspects of Indiana Jones that they would have had to have changed also.
Absolutely.
From movies in the 80s. So, that's one of the great things. I mean, you as a history professor probably see it also, how certain movies can be made at certain times, but not in other times. Even looking at the fact that this was made in 1998, we were talking on Friday about The Longest Day, A Bridge Too Far, stuff like that. Spielberg, if he would have been older, nobody would have been able to make a movie like this in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah. And this is why films are so interesting, right? Because let's take this example. We've got Saving Private Ryan here. And on one hand, it's all about 1944. It's all about June 1944. It's telling us something about the D-Day operation, the Battle of Normandy. But on the other hand, of course, it's telling us loads about the 1990s, about the time that it's made. That's the other history that, and as you say, it would be different because, it's 30 years later, it's a different moment.
Right. Yeah, no, that's very cool. I mean, like, you've mentioned that your part of your research that you do also deals with pop culture and stuff like that. So. Yeah. How do you do that from that perspective? Like if you're trying to compare this movie to The Longest Day, or I mean, again, I don't know the specifics of the type of research that you do about these type of things, but how do you look at do you look at the changes in the world as to the way that pop culture presents things as an example along the way?
Yeah, at root, that's the way into this. It's thinking about films as things that are made in a context, and to that extent they tell us something about that context. So we've got a couple of examples here. So Longest Day, 1962s, early 1960s, it's the era of Cold War tensions, it's the era of East-West rivalry, it's the era in which in Europe there are kind of questions about, especially in places like France, about the ongoing American military commitment to the continent, et cetera, et cetera. And here you've got in The Longest Day, Daryl Zanuck offering us this epic take of the alliance at war. And this is a battle fought by an international alliance, and it's painstaking in telling us that. You know, we've got representatives from everyone. There's Americans and Canadians and Britons and French there as well, all coming together in order to, you know, fight the good fight, to fight the battle for democracy and freedom. And so on that level, that's kind of a story of D-Day that's perfect for the early 1960s and this era of Cold War tension, and the free world is once again, you know, threatened by a new tyranny in the Soviet Union. Now, 1998, not now, but in 1998, very different moment. Cold War has ended. It's 50 years since the end of the Second World War. Veterans are aging. It's a kind of a climate of nostalgia for the war era, for the 1940s. You've got journalists like Tom Brocco coming up with a phrase to describe the veterans as the greatest generation. Yeah, and so you got and Saving Private Ryan is a film of that moment. It's a different context, different moment, different concerns. Tells a similar story to Longest Day in that it's about D-Day, but how it does so is of the 90s.
Right. I mean, I mean, even if you take movies like Hacksaw Ridge or things like that, which obviously it's showing a different it's a different theater of World War II, you know, because it's dealing with the Pacific theater. But, you know, when Mel Gibson made that movie, he also, you know, wanted to show the brutality of how everything is done. But as much as I love Hacksaw Ridge, which I do, I think it's an amazing movie that tells such a powerful story in a more or less simplistic way. Okay, but it's still not Saving Private Ryan from that perspective, and that probably has more to do with the director himself. As to the way he wanted to present things, I'm not sure if someone were to be able to make something as powerful as what Spielberg does here. Before or after.
And you got me thinking. The other film that comes to mind when I think about Saving Private Ryan is the other World War II film of 1998, but which does a very different thing, tells a very different type of story, and it The Thin Red Line.
Right.
Same year, but the other side of the world. It's set in the Pacific Theater, and of course it's based on James Jones' book, and it's in some respects it's quite a meandering tale. I think it got unfairly compared and contrasted at times to Saving Private Ryan when they both came out. Very different film. And it's powerful in its own way, but it's approaching the history of World War II in a very different way.
Right. I mean, I'm not much of a fan of Terrence Malick's movies because I just find them really boring. you mentioned Thin Red Line. I've tried to watch it numerous times, and every single time I watch it, I'm like, okay, where's the story here? You know, the story that he's trying to tell there is not being shown on the screen. That's the thing, and you know. To me, when I watch a movie, I want to see what's going on. I want there to be something for me to think about and contemplate, you know, as we're doing here with Saving Private Ryan. But there, it's a little too amorphic in my perspective, you know.
I hear where you're coming from there. It's a meandering tale. It's beautifully shot, but I know what you mean about the kind of the story, the center of the story there. It can be a little bit difficult to discern what it is he's trying to do. Yeah, I hear you.
Okay. That's just my opinion of it. No. So basically, in this minute, we're continuing the conversation between Miller and Horvath. And, we ended yesterday with Miller and with the two of them basically discussing the fact that Miller's hand is shaking. And, you know, at a certain point, Miller just says, well, it's just happening. I don't know why it's happening. You know, it's happened ever since since I got to England. That was it, you know. Yeah. And so at this point, Mike then says to him, well, you may have to get yourself a new line of work. This one doesn't seem to agree with you anymore. So it's an interesting line, you know, because as we mentioned, it's acknowledging that this is a problem, but it's not going too deep into what the problem is. And he's, you know, basically saying you need to, you know, find some other type of work. I mean, obviously anyone who's seen this movie already knows what Miller does for a living. You know, he's an English teacher. From that perspective.
And it's one of the interesting things about this scene, because again, it doesn't say lots, but at the same time, it does say lots. And what it's telling us there is that this is not his first fight, right? This is not the first time he's been to war. This is not his first combat that he has been involved in previous campaigns. And, and in that respect, it kind of tallies with another of the scenes, early, I think it's earlier on in the film, where Tom Selleck's character is not Tom Selleck, Tom Sizemore's character, sorry, Tom Sizemore's character is there on the beach, and he scoops up some sand,
yes,
puts it into a jar, and then we see the bag open up, and there's a whole bunch of them. There's a whole bunch of tins with sand from all the battles
he's right. We see Africa and Italy beyond. We see France, Africa, and Italy. Those are the three exactly. things that are so right.
Yeah. And so this scene with Miller shaking hand, it's kind of picking that up, right? It's telling us that this is a consequence of all that he's seen and experienced and done, which then the scene tells us a little bit more about when it references Anzio.
Correct. I mean, we even mentioned it, I think it was 2 weeks ago, with the fact that, you know, when the characters are having a discussion as to what they know about Miller, and then, you know, Horvath even says, I've been with him since we were in Italy, and I know nothing about him.
Yeah, yeah. Was it a robot made from body parts or something? It's the line in one bit of the film, isn't it?
No, that's even earlier. Where they discuss that not a robot made from body parts. He was an officer put that's together it. With spare body parts. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
And at this point, Miller just starts laughing, which probably is also part of his PTSD from that point. And then Horvath says, "What?" And he goes, "What? Nothing." And then he pauses for a second and he goes, what was the name of that kid at Anzio?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm assuming you know what Anzio was.
Yeah. So one of those big Allied invasions, which takes place before D-Day. There's the North Africa landings. There's the Sicily and Italy and Anzio. And so it's one of those earlier campaigns that these guys have been involved in. And it's another powerful moment, right? So we've got a little glimpse here of what all of the sources say is kind of a key feature of the experience of combat, that trauma happens, that soldiers are killed, and for those around them, in that instant, in that moment, there's often not the opportunity to kind of grieve or to mourn or to remember or to reflect. So here we've got a moment just in the lull between the fighting, in a church where Miller is just taken back to the not too distant past and to someone he used to command and to a kind of an earlier trauma.
Right. I mean, again, the Battle of Anzio was fought between January 22nd, 1944 and the 5th of June, 1944. So, you know, obviously, you know, Miller and his men weren't there just a few days ago. They were probably there like a month or two beforehand or whatever it is. Actually, it was probably even more than that, because they were doing all of their training for the invasion itself, you know, in England beforehand. Right. So they were probably there just at the beginning, or again, they're incorrect with the history here. That could be all stuff.
I think the assumption is that they're there a few months ago, and you're right. And the campaign goes through to the 5th of June. One of the great frustrations of some of those who fought in that campaign was that the 5th of June, the Allies take Rome, but that success is quickly overshadowed by what happens on the 6th of June.
Yeah. It's interesting because it wasn't planned that it would be we finish this and then we start that, because it's not the same. Not the same battalions that are fighting in the whole thing or whatever. But as you said, it's a very very interesting coincidence that they the D-Day was supposed to be on the 5th itself.
It was, and of course, you know, bad weather means that it's delayed, and then there's a weather window, and then they go. And it's interesting as well, because in referencing Anzio, it's giving us a little clue that there is obviously a big picture to all of this, and that is that the Allied campaign in Europe has had different components. And you know, when when the US enters the conflict at the end of, in 1941, you know, the big conversations that happen in 1942 between the Americans and the British, it's over, you know, what's the strategy going to be? And there's a component of the Americans that that they want to go straight into France immediately, as quick as possible. Various reasons. One is because they know that's the only way to defeat Nazi Germany. The other is they're worried that the Soviet Union might fall. And if the Soviet Union falls, then it's going to be very tricky to then invade France. The British, on the other hand, want to pursue what Churchill would refer to as the soft underbelly strategy. He wants to go through North Africa and Sicily and Italy. And ultimately, there's a bit of a compromise worked out then. So initially, it's a North African and Mediterranean campaign. And then the Allied invasion of France is going to come, but not in 1943, as some of the American command originally wanted. It's going to come in 1944. So just in that little one word there, it's kind of hinting at that much bigger picture of the Allied strategy of World War II.
Right. And obviously most people don't get it because, you know, not everyone watches these movies are professors of history that know all that information. So, you know, that's why they need to be here to listen, to hear these things, enlighten them.
Absolutely. Or the other way to look at it is that I just spent way too long thinking about this, you know.
Not at all. I don't think so for a second. not for a second. So Miller started saying, so what was the name of that kid at Anzio? The one that was always walking around on his hands, you know. And he was singing that song about the man on the flying trapeze. Yeah. Okay, now do you have any idea what song he's talking about?
Do you know, I've been thinking about this. I can't. I'm sure if I did a bit of digging, bit of searching, I could maybe figure my way through, but I'm not sure. No, not sure.
Okay, so there is a song from the 19th century called The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze.
There you go.
Which was performed by it was about a trapeze artist named Jules Lyotard, and one of the main refrain of the song says he'd fly through the air with the greatest of ease, the daring young man on the flying trapeze.
Yeah, there you go. See, we're all learning.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just very funny that it's mentioned here. I mean, this is actually something that's been mentioned so many times in pop culture over the years. In The Little Rascals, they have a reference to it, where Alfalfa actually sings it in one of them. It's sung on the bus in It Happened One Night.
See, that makes real sense, right? Because this is Spielberg, and he knows his cinema history. He knows history. Right? So this is deliberate. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. What else? It was part of there was a Popeye the Sailor cartoon that if in 1934 that dealt with it. Also, the song was performed by Rudy Valli in George White's Scandals in 1934.
Yeah.
Also in 1934, Dick Powell sings it twice in the movie 20 Million Sweethearts.
Yeah.
The movie 1936, Bengal Tiger. You have circus performers singing the song. In 1952, there's a movie called Phone Call from a Stranger, where there are passengers on an airplane that sing the song while there's turbulence. The World War II movie from 1954, The Bridges of Toko Rai. Mickey Rooney's character when he's being transferred somewhere, we can hear the band playing the song. In what else was there? In the movie George of the Jungle from 1997, the song is being played while the title character is swinging on the vines. And in the 2013 version of The Lone Ranger, it's played in the background when they pass by a traveling carnival. So
it's done the rounds. Yeah.
Seriously. Uh-huh. And then Miller pauses for a second and goes, Vecchio. And then Mike concurs and goes, yeah, Vecchio. Now, I don't know if you know Italian. I don't. I had to look this up. But do you know what the word or the name Vecchio means?
I do not know. Enlighten me.
Okay. It means an old one, or just an old aged male character. which is very funny that here they're talking about this young kid and his name is Vecchio.
That is,
Sorry,
I guess, and I guess it's interesting as well, because one of the things that obviously Spielberg's doing here with the film is, so it's new and it's different in terms of its depiction of combat, those famous opening scenes. But on another hand, he's kind of working with a really well-established format, which is just the World War II combat film, the melting pot platoon, the idea of the unit of soldiers as representative of the United States in all of its kind of plurality, and just get a little bit of a sense of that there with that character.
Right, I mean that you get in most you got those John Wayne movies too. I mean, you have the I
Absolutely.
always remember the Sands of Iwo Jima. You have them talking to the
Classic.
guys, and you got the Italian guy, you got the Jewish guy, you got the guy from Brooklyn, you got like all the different ones. And this movie slightly does that.
Yes, it does. It kind of picks up on that.
Obviously in Band of Brothers you see it more, and it's more effective there because you know that that's actually true. The way that these guys were spread out all over America. But you have Wade, who seems like he's coming from a middle class family, but someone who's working hard. We'll talk about it later in the week, like what we can find out about Wade. And then we have Ryben, the typical Brooklyn guy, and then Caparzo is the typical Italian guy, and Mellish is the typical Jewish guy. Upham's the newbie who doesn't know anything. He is fitting them into these various characteristics of what you look for in this type of situation, but he does it well that you don't automatically, see that. You
And
don't
as we've
it
said,
doesn't jump out at you.
no, and it's not, as we said about a couple of the other bits in the film, it's not overly forced, it's not kind of
Right.
contrived, it's not, it's just subtle.
That's right. It's not in your face at all with the way that they do this. And then the two of them continue laughing, and Miller goes, "Yeah, Vecchio. Yeah, he was a goofy kid." And then Mike says, "Remember, he used to pee a V on everyone's jacket for Vecchio, for victory." And I love that the very end of this minute, the way that they do this is that. We hear Miller and Horvath talking, but they're showing us something completely different visually. We get to see Wade, and we see that Wade is listening in on their conversation, but he's still doing something that he deems is very important. Which goes back from just a few weeks ago when Caparzo was killed. So Wade actually has the bloody letter, and he's slowly. Reprinting the letter, which it's interesting the way that they do this. So first I'll just quickly go through the dialogue that Mike and Miller have. They goes Miller goes, "Yeah, he was so short. He was a midget, wasn't he?" Then he goes, "How did he even get to be a ranger?" So
And as you said,
I like the way they do that. It's
yeah, and it's another powerful scene, because it's on one hand there's a contrast at work here. So we see the conversation and there's laughter, even though they're remembering and reflecting, and they're remembering someone fondly. But there's laughter there, and it catches Wade's attention. And there's almost a sense that he's kind of like, why are they laughing? Yeah, after everything we've experienced and where we are and what I'm doing here, why are they laughing? But on another level, they're all engaged in the same thing. They're kind of engaged in acts of remembrance.
Right.
And so in the conversation, it's Vecchio fondly remembering Vecchio, and for Wade, it's doing his duty by his buddy. Right, he's transcribing the bloody letter so that it can be sent on, so that it's not lost. So all engaged in acts of remembrance, albeit in subtly different ways.
Right. And what's really cool is that when you're watching a movie this way, we can actually read part of the letter. You can pause it and see what it is. So first of all, the thing that really jumps out at me is the date on the letter. The letter is dated June 9th, 1944, which means that Caparzo wrote this the day that they started their mission. Again, we don't know exactly what day he died. Did he die on the first day or the second day or the or I think Miller dies on the 14th. So it's a question of like a total of 5 days that this whole this part of the movie is taking place. But it seems as if Caparzo wrote this letter on the day that he died. And it also says the day of the week. So I mean, this is dated, it's a Friday. June 9th is a Friday. Do you think that that's accurate?
Yeah, let's go with yeah.
Yes, it is.
There you go.
Yes, it is. It's yeah, you know, it's one of those things that it's possible that they get it right. It's possible to get it wrong, you know. So I mean, just to give a historical context of what happened on June 9th, 1944, which was a Friday. So the Battle of Ushant was fought off the coast of Britain between German and Allied destroyer flotillas. And the Allies had a victory, and the Germans lost two destroyers. The U.S. Fifth Army captured Tarquinia and Viterbo in Italy. There were two German destroyers that attacked Allied warships off the Ile de Bats. I don't really know where that is. It's an island in off of Brittany, France. Okay,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah,
and one of the two German destroyers ran aground and was wrecked, and the other one was torpedoed and sunk. Yeah, and then looking at the Pacific battle on that day, you have the Japanese destroyer Matsukaze. It was sunk by an American submarine Swordfish, and the Japanese destroyer Tanekaze was torpedoed and sunk in the Sibutu Passage by the USS Carter.
Yeah.
So, and obviously, you know, Caparzo writes his letter. You know, those are the things that happen on June 9th. And they set off on their mission here.
Yeah.
Exactly. So again, I just like the way that they do it. Now we can read also that you know, he says he's writing it on that day somewhere in France. You know, and we can see the address of where Mr. and Mrs. Caparzo live. They live on West 112th Street in New York.
Yeah.
And then you can start reading a little bit of it, but I think it's probably easier to read tomorrow when we actually see what Wade is writing. Because here there's some blood on the letter, you know, obscuring things slightly.
There is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the somewhere in France is an interesting bit, because it's obviously censorship meant they couldn't put into their letters exactly where they were. So yeah, it's a little reference to that there.
Do you think it's censorship, or do you think it's just they don't really know specifically where they are?
It's going to be a little bit of both, I think. But certainly it was, yeah, stuff would have been checked to make sure they're not sending anything on. Yeah.
Right. Well, Wade isn't doing any censorship here.
No.
Yeah. We never know if this letter actually gets sent for that very reason.
Yeah.
That's another problem. Right. All right. So, do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Just something interesting at the very end there, with reference to the peeing at the V on jackets, and a reference to Vecchio, and also a reference to victory. And it is kind of one of those symbols of World War II. Churchill makes it famous with his V sign,
mm-hmm.
V for victory. So a little nod to that there at that very final bit of the scene.
Yeah, I like that too. All right, so Sam, would you like to tell people where they can get in touch with you?
Sure. So you can you can find me on the web. My website is www.runninghistorian.com. But you can also find me on X at historian_Sam.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can send me an email to movearoundminute@movearound.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter, and you can now, which is now next, X. And you can also find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, earn this.
And this.